Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Don't wait for nobody to pass you a baton or a mantle. Don't look for a leader to follow. Be a leader. Be the change that you seek.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 190, a talk with Paradise Gray. Paradise began his career in hip-hop under the tutelage of masters like Pete DJ Jones and Disco King Mario. But he really hit his stride when he began booking hip-hop acts and hosting in 1986 at a nightclub in the heart of Times Square called the Latin Quarter. While at the club, he would have a front row seat to the introduction of a new generation of hip-hop artists, the key acts in what would come to be called the genre's golden age. After the Latin Quarter closed in 1988, Paradise would form the group X-Clan with some friends and deliver some of the most powerful, conscious rap of all time. Paradise has a new book about his time at the LQ called No Half-Steppin', an oral and pictorial history of New York City club, the Latin Quarter, and the birth of hip-hop's golden era. And it was that book that brought him to Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the man who told you to get up and dance at the LQ, Paradise Gray. Last year, we went just a few blocks north of here to the Allah School in Mecca, and we sat down with Allah B. He's the guy who runs the Allah School in Mecca and knew the father was sort of one of the original members of what was then the 5% Nation. And he talked to us about a night that was also very important to you, although I don't know how well you remember it, which is what was going on in Harlem the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, we got his take on it from, you know, he was, you know, a young adult by that time and trying to help out and working with the father and with the city government to try at least to keep the peace.
Check out episode 151 for more on this.
But that was the night that you came to New York City from North Carolina.
Absolutely.
As a four-year-old, do you remember or did your parents ever tell you anything about that night?
My mother and my brother have both told me that we got off the Greyhound bus and then we made our way to Harlem, not far from here, actually. And that Harlem was on fire. You know, my mom put me, my brother and sister on the Greyhound bus from a small town on a dirt road in Little Washington, North Carolina. And she decided that her children weren't going to grow up picking cotton and tobacco. And she had visited her sister who lived here in Harlem and her niece who had lived in the South Bronx. And she decided that this was a better life for us and we would have a greater opportunity. Little did I know how prophetic my mother was, because her niece, which was my cousin Susie, she lived in the Bronxdale Projects. And my mother stayed with her sister here in Harlem and dropped us off in the Bronxdale Projects in the same building that Disco King Mario lived in.
Disco King Mario was a pioneering DJ active predominantly in the 1970s in the Bronx. He influenced many hip-hop pioneers, including Busy B and Afrika Bambaataa.
Mario, I like to say that Mario was the first, like, hip-hop impresario. And when I say that, Mario was really responsible for starting a lot of DJs, giving them a place to play. Remember, there wasn't a lot of clubs. There was the Evilo, Friday's on that, that's on the west side. There really weren't any clubs here. But Mario was able to get to school, 123. So when you hear them old tapes, 123 the place to be, that's one of the early venues, right, of hip-hop, man, or what it came to be known as hip-hop.
Right.
And Mario was responsible for that, getting there.
Right, and that's definitely was a very important introduction to you, into music, into DJing. You used to see him practice and stuff. For people who might not be familiar with the name, what made him unique as a DJ?
Disco King Mario knew how to rock a party, man. He was a dancer, and he made sure that you could dance to his music. He played all the hot joints, and he would be behind the turntables, and he would be rocking. He would be dancing himself while he was DJing, and he was famous for doing the dance called the Snake now. You know what I mean? And nobody could do the Snake like Disco King Mario. And it was interesting because he was a well-dressed, slick-looking guy, very handsome, and at the same time, he had one of the toughest crews in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. His crew was so tough that we lived right in the middle of the Black Spade territory, and he had his own gang coexisting with the Black Spades, the Chuck City crew.
Crazy. I actually just saw Bam, not Bambada, but the other Bam who was involved in the Spades.
The Black Spades, yes.
The Black Spades.
Going way, way back to the early days of 75 and the Black Spades. Chilling with my homeboy, Muscle Man Ron, and the Boogie Down Bros, BKA P-Law. It was a privilege for people to see.
The Black Spades were a mostly African-American street gang started in 1968 at the Bronxdale Houses in the Soundview section of the Bronx. They followed the teachings of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, and were also influenced by the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground. They were participants in the famous 1971 Ho Avenue Peace Meeting, which was brokered in part by our episode 114 guest, Benji Melendez. You can check out that episode for a ton more on the gangs of that era. Afrika Bambaataa was the warlord of the Black Spades before leaving to form the Universal Zulu Nation on November 12, 1973, with several members following him. Interestingly, Cool DJ Herc, himself a hip-hop pioneer, credits many of the gangs for getting the hip-hop scene started. While the Spades still exist, in the late 90s, much of the younger members transitioned to the Blood Street Gang.
Quite a powerful character even
Absolutely.
Today.
Absolutely. They're alpha males all around.
Yeah, definitely. So Disco King Mario used to practice in the laundry room of the complex?
Yes, it was actually the laundry room was broken down. Somebody had long ago busted in the laundry room. And back then you had to put quarters in there and somebody busted open the things and ripped out all the money and everything. So it happened so many times that the housing projects said, forget about it. And so the machines were old and broken and rusted. So it was no longer a laundry room. It was really like they used it to store things. And like the janitor used it as a place to keep his stuff at. And I guess Mario just cleaned the place up real well and put his records and his turntables and speakers down there because his mom was like complaining about how loud he was banging the music in the crib at one point.
Right. And there was a connection to the Herculoids as well, to Herc's crew?
After I moved from the Bronxdale projects, we moved to the Highbridge section of the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And it was a hotbed of action, entertainment. It was like a whole city of its own up in Highbridge. And everybody speaks of hip hop coming from the South Bronx, but I like to throw in a little bit of information about the West Bronx. Well, first of all, Pete DJ Jones comes from the West Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
He lived on Anderson Avenue.
Yeah.
Pete DJ Jones was renowned not only for his legendary parties in the 70s and 80s, but also for being arguably the first DJ to work with two copies of the same record in order to extend the breakdown section, which he began doing in 1969.
And he had Pete's Lounge one block away from where I lived. I lived on 165th and Ogden Avenue, and Pete's Lounge was at 164th and Ogden Avenue. Well, at 167th and Ogden Avenue lived a young man named the Grand Imperial DJ JC.
John DJ Imperial J.C. Chavis was born in Harlem in 1961 and moved to the Bronx in 1973. He joined Kool Herc's Herculoids crew in 1975 and is widely considered the inventor of the speed cut style of DJing. He now owns and operates the internet radio station Flex103FM.com Radio. In the early 1980s, he and his brother formed the group Just Four,
who was the best old school DJ I ever saw. Everybody talks about Grandmaster Flash and Grand Wizard Theodore, and they should talk about Grandmaster Flash and Grand Wizard Theodore because they are amazing DJs also. But my favorite was JC and the Grand Mixer DXT.
You can find our interview with Turntablism Pioneer Grand Mixer DXT on episode 68.
His level of skill, him and JC, they invented real turntablism.
Yeah.
You know, and to this day, both of them will still put it on most DJs. Right. But JC, I wound up being JC's record boy. Mm-hmm. And, I learned so much about old school break beats. And, you know, I was one of those guys that I was like taking care of their records because they didn't, you know, they were moving so fast, records would be out of the cover. You know, they would be in the wrong place. You have a whole crate full of records getting scratched up for no reason. So I would clean the records off like my mom taught me and put them in the right sleeve and organize them in the crates, you know. And so JC wound up being Kool Herc's number one DJ in the Herculords.
Oh, okay.
So that's where that connection came in. But I also was mentored by PDJ Jones because, like I said, he had a bar one block from my house. And I was a little hustler when I was a kid. I sold newspapers. I packed bags at the supermarket. I carried people's bags home. I cut grass. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I did all the little hustles I could, you know, to, you know, try to make some money back then, you know? And so I used to sweep the front of Pete's bar. And at one point, I shoveled the snow and he would let me come in and clean up the bar after Friday and Saturday nights and put the glasses from the bar in the dishwasher and everything. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a great relationship with Pete and he would let me DJ. That went very well, you know, because I learned a lot about records and stuff, but it went sour when we started scratching.
He didn't like that.
Oh, my God. When Pete saw me scratching on his turntables, He came running over there. What are you doing to my records? I was like, these are my records. What are you doing to my needles? These are my needles. Get off my turntables, man. Don't be touching the records. He didn't like that.
Yeah, amazing. The other side of music that you got into young before your time at the Latin Quarter, which we'll talk about in a minute, was... And that helped with that was live sound.
Yes.
And you got an introduction to live sound from a group called Tuff.
Yes, sir.
And there's a member of that group that our audience might be interested in because of his family. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Tuff was in my neighborhood, before the DJs were even coming out, live bands would come out in the streets and jam.
Yeah.
The most prominent of those bands was a group named Tuff. And the lead singer and guitar player was a great gentleman by the name of Jimmy Morgan. And he had a small son at the time by the name of Tracy Morgan, who turned out to be Tracy Morgan, the comedian that we all know and love.
My father was really funny.
Mm-hmm.
He did stand up in Vietnam. Or as my grandmother was saying, Vietnam! Mm-hmm.
So your dad served in the armed forces?
Yes, he did.
Well, good for him.
Yeah. He went AWOL and made me.
Oh.
He told me.
Yeah. Well.
He said, I went AWOL and I made you.
Yeah.
And they live right on the back, like in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Their backyard met my backyard.
Wow.
You know, the building that the band would practice in. And I would be in my house hearing this incredible music playing out the kitchen window. Mm-hmm. And it was Earth, Wind, and Fire, but it did not sound like Earth, Wind, and Fire. It sounded bigger somehow, you know? So for a couple of weeks, I would listen to this music. I would just sit in the kitchen window listening. And I was like, now I got to find out where this is coming from. So I went around the corner. You could hear the music. I just followed the music to this basement. And when I peeked through the door, there was a live band doing all the R&B classics, You know, Stylistics, Delphonics, Blue Magic. And that made me love it because, first of all, my mother collected all of this incredible music. Mm-hmm. You know, she was my first program director. She brought home James Brown and George Clinton and Sly and the Family Stone. And every Saturday, or I can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday now, but we would watch Soul Train. me, my brother, sister, and my mom. Mm-hmm. And we would do all the dances and everything. And when it went off, we would do our own Soul Train line because we had all of the music that they were playing. Because mm-hmm. every Friday, my mom would go to the record store, come back with 45s of all the hottest music.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, you know, you start DJing. You have a group at one point early on. Mm-hmm. And you had a bit of a run-in with Kid Capri
yes.
before he was a DJ.
Kid Capri, who started DJing when he was 8, has done just about everything with everyone as a DJ and producer. But just for fun, here's a list of some of the artists he's worked with in no particular order. Grand Poobah, Busy B, KRS-One, Heavy D, Nice and Smooth, Jay-Z, Slick Rick, Snoop Dogg, Common, Nas, Melly Mel, Mary J. Blige, Raz Kaz, Fat Joe, Foxy Brown, Ghostface Killah, and Styles P.
How was he as a rapper back then?
Kid Capri was a good rapper. He's still a good rapper. You know, his albums may not have, you know, sold as much as a lot of artists did, but I think they're classics. I think Kid Capri is hip hop. You know, he can do anything he wants to do.
He is also.
And do it well.
Yeah, he is also the best DJ who I've ever seen in person.
Kid Capri is a natural, man. He must have had a mother like me.
He is amazing. So you got involved in the radio.
Yes.
And were working with the Awesome Two, who were a group, mm-hmm. but also had a radio show. How did that
Hold on, let me, before I answer that question, let me rewind that story about Kid Capri, because we didn't tell it. That story begins actually when Grand Imperial JC went to the Herculords. Me and another DJ that was down with him named DJ Playboy started our own crew. And we both were DJs, but I also rapped. And I got with two of my boys, Crazy Kev and Kid Zeke, and we formed the Brothers Three. So we was DJ Playboy and the Brothers Three. Mm-hmm. And we became really popular. We were the hottest crew on the West Side in High Bridge. Playboy took over as the best DJ, mm-hmm. you know, and we were the top crew. And so I wound up moving to Brooklyn. You know, when I moved to Brooklyn, a friend of mine named Iceman took my place in the Brothers Three, and Playboy was still their DJ, mm-hmm. but they had a falling out. And when they fell out, DJ Playboy got these young rappers who were called the Throwdown Four. Mm-hmm. He got them battle ready to battle against the Brothers Three, but Playboy reconciliated with the Brothers Three, and then he dropped the Throwdown Four. So now they were a crew with no DJ,
right.
No equipment, no way to practice. And, but they didn't stop. They just kept working on their thing, you know, on their own. And when I was still frequently, even though I lived in Brooklyn, I would come back to the Bronx frequently because I was still good friends with Playboy and all my old people in my hood. Plus, I was really good friends with Larry Davis.
Oh, wow. The Larry Davis.
Yes, the Larry Davis.
5-0 makes me want to flip. Larry Davis style got a nigga depressed while he's awaiting trial. It's okay, though.
In 1986, Larry Davis was wanted by the NYPD as a suspect in the murder of 4 drug dealers. When the police raided his sister's apartment on November 19th, Davis shot 6 NYPD officers. He then eluded capture for 17 days before he was captured, despite a massive police manhunt. While Davis was acquitted of attempted murder for the NYPD shootout and for the drug dealer murders, he was sentenced to 25 years to life on other charges. In 2008, he was killed in a fight with another inmate. Until the end of his life, Davis insisted that the police raid was not because of the murders, but rather because of his knowledge of the involvement of corrupt cops in the drug business. His time eluding capture made him somewhat of a folk hero amongst many New Yorkers who were frustrated with the police.
He lived 3 blocks from me in the other direction, 165th and Woodycrest. Mm-hmm. And he taught me how to ride motorcycles. I taught him how to DJ. He would ride to Brooklyn with a whole crew of motorcycle dudes. And then they would pick me up and I would ride back with them. You know what I'm saying? So we just riding motorcycles and DJing and having fun back then. So the young boys from the Throwdown Four, they asked me if I would be their DJ. Mm-hmm. And I agreed to be their DJ. So 2 of the members of the Throwdown Four wound up becoming a R&B group named 4x4. Mm-hmm. And they had a hit record called Come Over. Just a reference on them. But so the Throwdown Four quickly rose mm-hmm. to the top of hip hop on the West Side. And of course, the Brothers Three didn't really exactly like that. So Playboy had prepared them to battle the Brothers Three. So when it hit the fan, the Throwdown Four was ready to battle when the Brothers Three weren't. So anyway, the Throwdown Four wound up becoming very popular. Then we heard about a group called the Throwdown Three. And Kid Capri was one of the rappers in the Throwdown Three. So we went to their hood to battle them for the name, and we won.
And you won.
Yes.
And, Kid
and
Capri,
thank God for hip-hop that we won, because Kid Capri might have been more of an MC than he is a DJ.
Of course, of course. So how'd the Awesome 2 thing start?
Oh, that's another crazy story. So I'm living in Brooklyn by this time, and I have been listening to HBI since Mr. Magic.
Oh, my God, I think I'm having a rap attack.
And remember, you can have a rap attack only on the Mr. Magic Disco Showcase every Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday nights from 2 until 4 o'clock in the AM, only on Magic 106 FM WHBI.
Because you couldn't catch hip-hop. All this home of hip-hop and R&B radio stations didn't exist at that time.
Right. This is one of the one of the things that actually continued up through the early 90s was kind of the division in black music, the older generation not wanting to play hip-hop, especially on the radio side.
Yes, they were not feeling us. Now, they hit us with everything. We wasn't real music. We were stealing their music. You know, we're just a fad. We're temporary. We're going to go away quick.
Right.
Yeah, it was. We had to fight through a lot of that. But thank God for people like Mr. Magic, Red Alert, you know, the Supreme Team, mm-hmm. you know, and the Awesome 2.
You and your crew, keep out the Awesome 2. Yo, wake up and get some mucus out your eyes. Stop sleeping. Live from the underground street sounds, it's the original U-Child, Teddy said. And Special K, rocking for us.
You know my and Hank Love and DNA and all these guys that put in that time without really getting that big money. You know what I mean? They were doing it more for the love. And, you know, they came on late at night. And one day I was listening to the station and they would take requests. The Awesome 2 would play anything. If you sent them a cassette, they're going to play it. You know?
Yeah.
And so... You know, me growing up in hip hop, you know, the conversations they were having, the music they were playing, I was super into it. I wanted to get in on a conversation and I would call their request line and nobody would ever answer it. And I just got angry. And one day I just showed up at their door. And I knocked on the door to the radio station while they were on and they were like, yeah, can we help you? I said, yeah, my name is Paradise, blah, blah, blah. I gave them a short little bio, gave them my 1 minute speech. And I said, dude, I call all the time and no one ever answers the request line. Like, why? They were like, oh, our people that answer the request line haven't been showing up. I was like, can I answer it? They was like, yeah, sure. So I came every night and started answering the request line. And then one day the Awesome 2, they got a opportunity to create what they call Celebrity Tuesdays mm-hmm. at the Latin Quarter. And they asked me if I would be one of their celebrity judges.
Wow. And that started the whole thing. You were a journalist early on, too. I hadn't
yes.
realized with our good friend Bill Adler at a publication that I unfortunately hadn't heard of called the Hip Hop Hit List.
I was writing even before that. Mm-hmm. But I think the first article that I did write was inspired by Bill Adler. Because this is another hip hop story of mine. I had quit hip hop. I was 20 years old. I was working at a computer company mm-hmm. and on 1133 Broadway, on Broadway and 26th Street downtown in Manhattan. And one day I'm coming from lunch. I'm in the elevator. I got on a suit and tie now. I'm grown up. You know, I'm doing my grown man stuff. And I look at the guy in the elevator standing next to me. And I said, excuse me, sir, are you Curtis Blow? And he was like, yeah. I was like, what are you doing here in this building, man, where I work at?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, my manager, Russell Simmons, just opened his first office here. And
wow.
I was just like, wow. So I went down there and I met Bill Adler and Heidi Smith mm-hmm. and Steve Salem and Full Force and Russell Simmons. And they were all sharing an office that was no bigger than this room that we're in now. You know, it was just split into two rooms. So every day I would go down there and I would talk with Bill Adler and Heidi and Russell and everything. And I got to meet Rick Rubin early on at his NYU dorm.
Wow.
And the Beastie Boys, you know, very extremely young.
Mm-hmm.
And one day something happened and I went to Bill Adler and I complained about the way that they treat people in hip hop and things like that. And he said, so he was like, I think a guy had actually written an article in the Big Red News disrespecting hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, why don't you write the editor? And I had never thought of doing anything like that. He was like, yeah, send a letter to the editor. And I did. And the editor was impressed with my letter. And he hit me back. He said, well, if we're so ignorant about hip hop and you know so much, why don't you write for us about it? And I said, okay.
I said, okay.
And I started writing for Big Red News. Mm-hmm. It was like a numbers paper in Brooklyn. And then Bill Adler got me an opportunity in a housing magazine to write an article about LL.
Mm-hmm.
And then he hooked me up with Cynthia Horner, and I began writing for Right On Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hip Hop Hit List, a couple guys from Jersey, you know, they came to Latin Quarter and met. No, actually, I met them at the Roxy, and I began writing for them. So I'm one of the pioneering hip hop writers. I've never written about anything except hip hop.
Incredible. And speaking of the early days at Rush and Def Jam and all that, I know you were close with LL, and he even crashed with you when he didn't have a place to stay, right?
Yes, yes. that's funny. I got real close with LL because going back to 1133 Broadway, LL would show up at Russell's office every single day, and he would just rap until they told him to shut up. And then he would keep rapping. So Heidi would call me and be like, by the end of the day, they couldn't take it. They'd be like, Paradise, please come get LL. So I would go downstairs and I would grab him. I would take him across the street to the sandwich spot, which was Blimpie's at the time,
mm-hmm.
and buy him lunch and, you know, let him come back and sit with me upstairs to the end of the day. And I would take him to the clubs with me, 15, 16 years old.
Yeah, you know, people always forget. I do, at least, how young he was when he started out.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, and just had this confidence and vocabulary so far beyond his years back then.
I'm the greater insulator, microphone dominator. My name is LL, manipulator, innovator, connoisseur.
LL Cool J was only 17 years old when his debut album Radio was released in 1985.
And he had no shame with his game. We would be on the subway and he would be rapping so loud. I would be so embarrassed. Everybody would be looking at us like, what is wrong with that dude?
Oh, man. If
but
only,
he knew
if
something
only
knew. That all yeah. of us didn't.
Yeah. Incredible. So the Awesome Two start their night at Latin Quarter. You're there as a judge because you're kind of hanging out with them, helping them out. What was the club like around? Is it maybe 84 you start going there for the first time?
Actually, it was 85 when I first went there. Yeah, and the Awesome Two's first Tuesday was actually in 86.
Okay.
So the Latin Quarter was only really in operation for 2 years to 2.5 years. But in that short period of time, what was done was just unprecedented. It, like, 10 to 12 years worth of serious work put into that short time.
Yeah. So what was it like? You first go there in 85 for this Tuesday, Saturdays, or Latin night,
actually, yeah,
whatever.
The Tuesdays, it wasn't really that spectacular when I first went in there to do the Celebrity Tuesdays because I think, you know, being at the Awesome Tour from Jersey and this show comes on so late at night, you know, they had like a niche audience. And then for people to come to a hip-hop show on a Tuesday night,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of tough.
Right. There wasn't the whole sort of, you know, hip-hop record industry that would support nights
right,
like that.
Right, right. The underground hadn't really blossomed yet. You know what I mean? And back then, everything in hip-hop was celebrity-driven. You know what I mean? But it was a great club. But I didn't really even understand the potential right away until one night I was going to a movie on 42nd Street. We used to go to the Kung Fu House,
mm-hmm.
we called it. It was called the Cine 42nd, C-I-N-E 42. And you could get 3 Kung Fu movies, popcorn, hot dog, and a drink for $10.
Got to bring that back, man.
You know what I mean? And we would like watch Jackie Chan marathons and Bruce Lee marathons there. You know, me and DJ Playboy and Kid Zeke would come down from the Bronx and just chill there back in the day. So here I am, I go watch the karate movies, and after I was like, I wonder what the Latin Quarter's like on a Friday night, because I had never been to the club on a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a reggae after party when I went. A gentleman by the name of David Levy, who was a very popular personality in reggae radio and club scene here in New York.
Yes, man! No respect, no disrespect to all my radio and DJ brother. As a matter of fact,
David Levy was born in Barbados and grew up in London. After moving to New York City in the 1980s, he was the first person to host a Caribbean focus show on mainstream radio in the city. It was such a success that he was soon on three radio stations simultaneously.
He was doing the reggae after party, and I went there, and the club was absolutely packed. I had never seen it like that before. And the sound system was turned up louder than I ever heard it. And it was reggae. And the bass was just shaking your chest. And you look out on the dance floor, everybody was on the dance floor dancing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I realized, I was like, there's nothing like that in hip hop. You go to a hip hop show, you stand around, you watch the show. You know, you do, you know, a circle of breakdancing might pop out. Some guys might start pop locking, but mostly people dance to like the disco records and, right. you know, the other things that came. Well, you didn't really dance to hip hop. You listen to Run DMC, you watch them, you pause, you got in your B-boy stance and you tried to look cool
right.
at a club. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when the reggae party emptied out, a Latin party started. You know, the same night. And DJ, I can't think, is it Rohan or DJ Roman was rocking. And once again, the Puerto Ricans, they danced. At that time, you couldn't even win a talent contest. If there was two Puerto Ricans in it that was doing the hustle, that was an L. You was losing that. I don't care if it was a contest at the FIVA. Or with Roseland, mm-hmm. or wherever you go,
yeah.
if it's a talent show, it's getting won by two Puerto Ricans doing a hustle. You could not compete with that.
Amazing.
You know?
Yeah.
So they danced, and they had a whole bunch of different like dances that they did to disco. And it was amazing. Again, the sound system was cranked up. The people were dressed well. They were beautiful. And the whole dance floor was popping. So I just really, it gave me a vision that I needed to recreate that kind of energy for dancing in hip hop.
And you did. So you get this Saturday and you start booking and hosting. Now, as a host and as a booker, what were your ideas? Where'd your style as a host come from? What were you thinking about when you were trying to book acts? Like, how did that whole thing develop?
Basically, call my friends. See who want to rock. Who's hot? Call them. Hey, yo, you want Rock Friday? Yeah. All right. Yo, how much? I got $1,500 for you. Oh, okay, good. No hotel, no limousine, no managers, no booking agent. I just call Daddy-O. You know, I just call Search. You know, I just call Just Dice. I just call whoever, you know, these are people I know
mm-hmm.
because we're playing their records on the air with the Awesome Toot.
Ah.
We're playing stuff that the mainstream radio haven't even heard about yet.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we're the antithesis of hip-hop as it already existed. We were playing, you know, and I started really focusing on dance music. And the artists that I was booking, they were making music for the Latin Quarters, you know?
Yeah.
Once they seen what was popping, and it was amazing. It's like, if the IOU dancers and the JAC dancers come running out on the floor and start dancing when your record played at the Latin Quarter, you had a hit. It was that simple.
Yeah. And one of the big sort of blocks in your success, one of the big parts of your success were your DJs.
Absolutely.
So how on earth did you get Red Alert and Chuck Chilla, both of whom were popular on the radio at that point, to be regular DJs? And once the club started popping, how did you keep them there?
You know, when we started, we were just rocking with our house DJs. We didn't have a world-famous DJ at the Latin Quarter yet. And Union Square had Red Alert. And they opened up a couple months after we did. But I was jealous as hell that they had Red Alert. I knew Red Alert since I was back in the South Bronx. And I loved that dude. But we couldn't afford him doing Celebrity Tuesdays. Once the Union Square closed down, Red Alert was available. And I immediately reached out to him like, yo, you know, I would like you to, you know, come DJ at our spot right after you get off the radio. And Chuck Tillout, you know what I'm saying? And Red Alert understood that we had location, location, location.
Right.
Come on. You could not beat the spot that the Latin Quarter was in. It was in the middle of Times Square, 48th Street between Broadway and 7th Avenue. In Times Square, you have the building that the ball drops.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the big empty space. Then you had the building with the Coca-Cola bottle on it. The Latin Quarter was in the building with the Coca-Cola bottle.
Amazing. Can you describe what it looked like on the inside
for people
who didn't have a chance to go?
Okay. The most different and amazing thing about the Latin Quarters was the stage. It was a small stage. It wasn't very wide. It was probably about 10 foot to 12 foot deep. And it was like 12 feet in the air off the dance floor.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody in the place had a good seat. You didn't have to, anybody, I don't care who was in front of you, you could still see the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a smaller semicircular stage at the bottom of the main stage. And then the dance floor was in a circle around that stage. And on the side, you had two areas where people could sit at tables that most clubs now would be VIP areas.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Latin Quarter, the whole entire club was a VIP area. You know?
So actually, speaking of that kind of stuff, of VIPs, one of the things you had to do as the booker, as the host, was finesse the guest list.
Yes, sir.
And I assume there were plenty of people who wanted to get in for free every week.
And we let them in free every week. If you had a record out, or if you worked in the music industry,
mm-hmm.
fashion industry, if you were a singer, a dancer, if you were popular for anything, you got in free at the Latin Quarter. You got VIP treatment. You got free drinks. And you got treated like a superstar. And on that note, all the superstars like to show up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they got treated the way that you're supposed to treat a star.
Interesting. And, you know, one of the people who pops up again and again in stories about the club is Melly Mel. What was he like back then? Let's start there.
Melly Mel was a hip-hop Debo.
Are you tripping, Debo? Sure. Fuck, I'll knock your ass out.
Oh, man, that's messed up. Won't you give him back his chain?
What chain?
Yeah, what chain?
He was the neighborhood bully that nobody wanted none of him. They didn't want none of him on the mic, and they definitely didn't want none of him physically.
Sure, yeah.
You know, he was, back then, he was calling himself Muscle Simmons.
Too funny.
And Melly Mel and Busy B would run around the Latin Quarter, talk about, we knocking out all bums. We knocking out all bums. Y'all ain't getting no money. All y'all getting is the crumbs.
But interestingly, what happened from the movement that the club actually spawned is that there was this generational shift, and Melly Mel and Busy Bee and people of that sort of early 80s era were left behind.
Yes.
By the very people they were running around knocking out.
Absolutely.
What was that like to see and to kind of preside over? Did you know that was sort of happening at
absolutely.
The time?
Absolutely.
You could feel
absolutely.
The shift, like 86, 87?
The shift happened. I mean, the shift between those things happened. The first shot across the bow was LL versus Kool Moe Dee.
I'm bigger and better. Forget about Defa. Every time I rock the mic, I left a stain in your brain that will remain stuck in the back of your brain until you see me.
How you like me now? I'm getting busier. I'm double platinum. I'm watching you get dizzier. Check out the way.
And then the nail in the coffin was KRS-One and Grandmaster Melly Mel. You know, and one night, like Melly Mel, you'd be on the stage. Dudes would be on stage doing their show. And Melly Mel would show up on the side of the stage with his shirt off. Then he would come out while you're rapping, start doing push-ups in the middle of your set. And then if you're intimidated and you're shook by it, he'd get up and snatch your mic and take over your show. You know, Melly Mel rolled in like to the new music seminar. He had one the battle for world supremacy. They gave them like a WWF style golden belt.
Right.
Melly Mel won the New Music Seminar's Battle for World Supremacy in 1987.
The next year, Mikey D won. And Melly Mel shows up at with his belt and challenges Mikey D to a battle belt for belt. And the winner take both, you know? And Melly Mel lost and took both belts anyway and dared anybody to come take it back from him.
According to Mikey D, Melly Mel actually showed up dressed like a professional wrestler and brought Grandmaster Kaz dressed up like a referee with him. Immediately after the battle, while Mikey D's back was turned, Kaz grabbed both of the belts and walked off with them. Big Daddy Kane even tried to stop Melly Mel. Melly Mel pushed Kane right down the stairs. Mikey never did get the original belt back, although the organizers did get him a bigger and better one.
You know, so he was Devo for real.
Right.
And one night, Melly Mel showed up at the Latin Quarter, and I think KRS-One was performing, and Melly Mel came out on stage, challenged anybody in the crowd. I got $500. I'll take any of y'all out. Da 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 da. KRS-One wasn't shook, and he didn't back down.
He was like, ooh. Like Mel. And I look, Mel was right there. Now, mind you, Melly Mel is my idol.
Yeah,
okay. This dude did the message, started my whole, okay, that's where I was inspired from. So here he is now challenging. The dude you look up to is now in your face with beef. Yo, bull. So I'm like, oh, this is crazy. A little fear came over me at the time because it wasn't about Mel. It was about, this is Melly. It wasn't about the battle. It was Melly Mel. This dude was the illest, okay? Yeah, you
he
know.
Was, he was.
I
he
know.
Was.
He jumped on stage in his heyday. But it wasn't about intellect. It was about the spirit. It really was. Because, first, I don't think the crowd liked how he challenged me. So he started on the wrong foot. The crowd paid to see me perform. They was like, we don't want to hear you. Want to hear him. Why are you dissing Chris? That started the rumbling in the audience. So he said a rhyme. I stopped the show and said, let's battle. He got a mic. And the owner of the club, a guy named Mike Goldberg, gave me $500 extra to battle him. He said, I'll put the five up. Mike Goldberg, he owned Latin Quarters. He saw Mel come in. He said, I got the $500,000 to get.
Beep, what beat was it?
It was Funky Trouble. 1, 2, 3, 4, hit it. Boom, boom, pop, boom, 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 boom. Mel went first. Go.
Ain't it funky. He went first and did an incredible freestyle talking about what was happening right at the time. And at that time, KRS-One was right in the foundation of the battle with MC Shan. The South Bronx was popping. I think he may have just even released The Bridge Is Over. So KRS-One was fire hot at the Latin Quarters.
Yeah.
You know? And Melly Mel challenged the wrong night. And he did an incredible rhyme. You know, Melly Mel did one of the greatest rhymes I ever heard in my life. But the crowd was tone deaf at that point.
And that was a real shift to
that
this whole
shift.
Generation that,
right.
that would later come to be called the Golden Age, kind of
exactly.
like 87
and then, and
to
And then you've seen the emergence of Big Daddy Kane, KRS-One, Chuck D, Rakim, you know what I'm saying, Kool G Rap, and it was on and popping at that point.
Yeah. So two of the groups most associated with the club, out of all the people who performed there, all the legendary performances, the two groups that are so closely associated with the club and with the aesthetic of the club were Stetsasonic and the Ultramagnetic MCs.
Yes.
Why do you think those two groups sort of went so well with kind of what was going
on? Well, first
of
all, those were my best of friends.
There you go.
You know, that was my go-to guys. You know, when I didn't have a big budget or I couldn't get the group I wanted, I fall back. I could always fall back on Ultramagnetic or Stetsasonic. We used to joke that we go to the Stetsasonic to see Latin Quarters. You know,
yeah.
But Stetsasonic was the hip hop band, and the the drummer was our one of our house DJs, Bobby Simmons.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying? And, you know, and I came in the door, you know, I was best friends with Daddy-O and Stet from the Roxy. Mm-hmm. You know, so we were really all familiar with each other. And Lumumba Carson, a.k.a. Professor X, also had a great relationship with Stet. And Stet would always look out for me. They would always, you know, if I needed a favor, they always stepped up. And guess what? They never disappointed the crowd. I don't care how many times you watch Stetson Sonic perform, you're going to see something new. You're going to see something fresh, and you're going to see a great show. And Sed G from Ultramagnetic, Sed G's drums were made and married to the Latin Quarter sound system. The Latin Quarter sound system would shake your foundation when Ego Tripping by the Ultramagnetic came on.
People's in the place to be. Just for you, it's the Ultramagnetic MC.
When that Ultramagnetic song came on, the dancers rushed the floor. And every week they'd have a new dance on these beats. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you look forward to that. So the energy in the club when a Stetson Sonic song or an Ultramagnetic song played, the dancers were all over it. And that's what was like the main important part of the Latin Quarter experience.
Yeah, more than just the dancers with some of the Stet songs, right? They were the notorious Go Brooklyn chant.
Go Brooklyn. Go Brooklyn.
And if you've ever seen Brooklyn rock, rock did not stop break.
Whenever Brooklyn get too motivated, such as when Ghost Stetson would come on or Brooklyn's in the House by Cutmaster DC.
Just get out your seat, rock to the beat, cause we're about ready, make you move your feet. It's
Brooklyn's in the house.
They would lose their minds and think that was some kind of cue for them to start snatching chains.
And, you know, I did want to talk about that for a second because you had the Fort Greene Posse, they're sometimes called. You refer to them as the Brooklyn Zoo, the kind of like.
Also the A-Team. They had a whole bunch of names.
And we've had, you know, Supreme Magnetic. We talked to him a little bit when we met with Rakim. He was there, you know, several years ago. He's been on the show. They're still notorious in hip-hop lore, you know, if for no other reason than they're on the cover of one of the most famous albums of all time.
Some members of this many-named group are pictured on the back cover of Eric B. and Rakim's 1987 classic, Paid in Full. People in the crew included Supreme Magnetic and his brother Rap, Killer Ben Ogaro, and Kelvin Martin, better known as the original 50 Cent.
What were those guys actually like in your club to the extent you interacted with them?
Well, they were really actually cool with me, you know what I'm saying? I grew up in the South Bronx, and, you know, I've been around, you know, entertainers and gangsters and drug dealers, pimps, all my life. You know what I mean? So, you know, I was raised by alpha male, you know what I'm saying, in a community that was dominated by alpha males. So I got along great with those dudes, you know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, I treated Supreme Magnetic, Rap, and 50 Cent like they were rap stars, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had a different, you know, my security wanted to just always try to kick them out or treat them real bad because they knew that... You know, things like that. But I gave them something to lose. Mm. You know, I was like, look, I'm going to treat you well. I'm going to give you the utmost respect. But you got to respect me. This is how I make my money. This is my club. You know, so 50 Cent would actually come and ask me if people was my friends before he snatched their chain. And I was honest about it. They're like, yo, is that your boy? I'd be like, nah, I don't know him. And he'd be like, yo, man. Tice, he think he wearing a chain, but he wearing my rent next month. So if I was, he said, go holler at him, tell him go to leave now or go take that chain off. Because I don't know, you know that dude, he's rocking too much. He's being disrespectful. Like, I won't take it.
Amazing. And yeah, he was obviously one of the most notorious stick-up people of his generation. Another sometimes notorious crew that was around the Latin Quarter a lot were the Violators.
Yes.
Red Alert's crew, who started out, you know, carrying his records and helping him out and stuff. When did you first become aware of the Violators?
The first day Red Alert came to the club. I had to go down there and let them all in.
who was part of that at the time? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember Baby Chris Lighty.
Mm-hmm. God bless him.
I don't remember everybody's names, man. Mm-hmm. I hate that. But Sugar Shaft was with them when I first met them. You know, thank God for the Violators and Red Alert. It wouldn't have been no X-Clan.
Incredible.
Because Sugar Shaft was the one who brought Brother Jay to me at 16 years old.
It's so people always forget, because of how deep his voice is, how young he was when all the X-Clan stuff popped off.
Absolutely. And Sugar Shaft and Brother Jay used to search people's pockets at the Latin Quarter.
One of the sort of odd bits of trivia about the club is that it created so many stars that even your coat check girl became a star.
Exactly.
It's
ridiculous.
Can you tell me a little about that? So Heather Hunter, who some of our listeners may know, was your coat check girl.
After her time checking coats at the LQ, Heather Hunter would become a very well-known adult film actress, appearing in over 60 movies. She was inducted into the industry's AVN Hall of Fame in 2003.
And she answered the phones during the week. She was a young girl who basically was homeless. She lived in the Latin Quarter at one point. She was this amazing personality and a very pretty face. So, you know, she was a great dancer, which a lot of people didn't know. Heather Hunter was one of the best hip hop dancers in the Latin Quarter, too. Also, a bit of trivia, she was an art student of Keith Haring.
Oh.
And Keith Haring had an art program for homeless youth.
Mm-hmm.
And she was mentored and taught to paint by him. And when I look at her style of painting, I like hers better than his. She's an amazing, talented person. She can really, really dance. And she can really, really... She's a great photographer and an incredible painter.
And did you ever watch any of her movies, or was that just too weird?
Of course, that's my girl.
And, you know, there were so many people who performed there, and, you know, we could just go on all day, and there are a ton of stories in the book. I would absolutely encourage people to read it to find out more about the club. But one thing that I heard about the club was that when Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince first performed there, people loved Jeff. They were blown away by him. They were kind of lukewarm about the guy who was rapping.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that?
Well, remember, the Latin Quarters was hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Latin Quarters was a place where you could go and you could have sex with Heather Hunter or get knocked out by Mike Tyson on the same night.
Right.
You know, that same night you could get your face slashed with a razor blade and get robbed by 50 Cent. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was tough. You know, hip hop was hardcore back then, you know, and Jazzy Jeff was kind of soft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Will Smith, but people loved this song though, anyway.
Listen, homeboys, don't mean to bust your bubble, but girls of the world ain't nothing but trouble. So next time a girl gives you the play, just remember my rhymes and get the hell away.
You know, and it was the age of storytelling. You know, you had Slick Rick, you know,
mm-hmm.
you had Just Ice telling stories, but you know, for us, Will Smith was a little soft, but Jazzy Jeff, you know, we come from a DJ culture. That's the foundation of hip hop. So we were blown away by him.
DJ Jazzy Jeff, I want y'all to bust the move and it goes something like this.
And at the time, we were fortunate enough to have DJ Jazzy Joyce, DJ Clark Kent, and Cutmaster DC, who made Brooklyn's in the House,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing performances at the Latin Quarter often. So it was perfectly set up for a DJ like, you know, Jazzy Jeff to come through, you know, and smash.
Incredible. And is it true that Schoolie D used to get booed every single time?
No. No? It's not true that he got booed every single time.
Sometimes.
People loved PSK. Gucci time.
PSK were making that green. People always say, what the hell is that mean? Looking at my Gucci, it's about that time. The answer's moving to start humming the rhyme. I heard you was out
there. You know, but then when he went, he changed up a lot, just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the footages that exists, there's very, very little footage of people performing at the Latin Quarter.
Right.
And one particular great piece of footage that does exist is Schoolie D performing at the Latin Quarter. And it was part of a Dutch documentary.
All these crazy Europeans were running around in the mid-late 80s.
And you could clearly see that Schoolie D was very welcomed and at home on stage at the Latin Quarter because of the factual footage that existed.
Makes sense.
You cannot, you know, look at that and say, oh, no, it wasn't like that.
So KRS-One, obviously, like you mentioned, an important figure in the days of the Latin Quarter. But on one of his most famous songs, he shouted out your competitor, right? The name of this routine is Live at Union Square.
Yeah.
Moving over there and then we're moving over here. This name of this routine is called Live at Union Square. Square.
Did you kind of feel a way about that?
Yeah, I was mad at that. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, we broke the South Bronx at the Latin Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the whole battle started at the Latin Quarter because the bridge, MC Shan's The Bridge, that was another Marley Marl's production was also married to the Latin Quarter. I mean, a Marley Marl beat come on, it rocked because of the sonics of it. It was just perfect for that Latin Quarter sound system.
Yeah.
And MC Shan was very popular in the Latin Quarter. So was Mr. Magic. But, and Roxanne Shante, Bismarck, I would say that the Latin Quarter was the home of the Juice Crew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to see how it all transpired, though. You know what I mean? But we got the last laugh because, like I said, Union Square wound up shutting down.
Shutting down anyway.
Red Alert wound up coming to the Latin Quarter.
Yeah.
But I personally handed Red Alert the acetate of the South Bronx, you know, and played it before he got on. And the crowd, we played it like 6 to 8 times before Red Alert ever came that night. You know, Scott LaRock showed up early in the afternoon with KRS-One and Miss Melody. And at the time, Chris was still homeless. And Scott was his counselor at the homeless shelter. And he handed me the acetate. He said, yo, man, we got this new joint with my homeboy. I think it's dope, you know. So I took it in the club. I played it. I thought it was incredible. I gave it to our house DJs. They played it 6 to 8 times before Red Alert even showed up that night.
Mm-hmm.
When Red showed up, gave it to Red, played it, and Red played it 5, 6 times that night. So I was angry. I was disappointed. I was mad as hell that KRS-One said the name of this routine is called Live at Union Square. I was like, what? But KRS-One did reference the Latin Quarter, and so did Scott LaRock in many of their other records. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I'm on my way on the Latin Quarter to find 2 more freaks.
Word. I come from an era of OJ cars, Latin Quarter, fake Gucci, and fake Fendi. You can't see me in Tony Touch. Came to me in the clutch. And he said, yo, KRS-One, man, I want you to get on this record and just represent for the Latin Quarter crew, you know, the class of 87.
Can't be too mad.
Yeah.
And why did it shut down? The book doesn't really go into this so much.
It shut down because of money. It was a Latin Quarter got gentrified and they built the hotel, the Renaissance Hotel on the spot. You know, somebody bought the whole building, bought the whole block and, you know, money talk.
Right. That makes sense. And can you tell me a little bit about the transition into X-Clan and what I'm most interested in, because you've talked about, you know, the Black Watch movement and all of that a lot before, musically, How did the sound of X-Clan come about? Because that was sort of a collaboration between everyone. And I think given your background as a DJ, you probably played a large part in that.
Which is why they call me the architect.
Right. How did the sound of X-Clan develop? What was your thought process when you were putting that together?
Well, the sound of X-Clan developed being a great fan of hip hop and the foundations of hip hop, which is James Brown, George Clinton, Sly and the Family Stone and such. Having that background, I basically produced X-Clan off of my mother's crates. Once again, you know, and the influence that she had on my life. But basically, when I met Professor X and we began forming the foundations of the Black Watch movement at the Latin Quarter.
In observation and intolerance of the shackled state that blackness is in, a step has been created, the Black Watch movement. Black Watch is a spearhead movement adding on to the weapon called black nationalism.
Brother Jay of X-Clan explained the following about Black Watch, which was founded by Lumumba Carson, a.k.a. Professor X of X-Clan. Black Watch movement was a black nationalist movement that blended with the hip-hop generation. The goal of Black Watch was to take those kids that were bored of the same old approach of black nationalism. Someone is standing in front of the podium just pointing a finger at what's wrong and everybody's saying yay or nay. But Lumumba's goal was to add some flavor to that. It's just like having young kids in church nowadays. You look at a church now, it's upbeat with Kirk Franklin and stuff. They kind of added the hip-hop twist, and it's attracting young kids to come back to the church. So we wanted to get people to stand up for their rights a little closer. And although we say black nationalism, it's basically aimed at improving the black environment. We're not meant to be a prejudice circle. It's just that we want to improve our environment.
We heavily relied on the feeling. It wasn't even so much the sound of the song, but the vibration and what that song meant to black people when it originally came out was important to the vibration that we were trying to make people feel at that time, because we wanted people to really feel the soul of what we were saying. We were trying to appeal to the heart chakra and the upper chakras and the pineal gland. You know, we were trying to like get to the third eye and give people a vibration with the music of a time before, because we were practicing Sankofa, to go back and fetch the best things that our ancestors had to offer.
My brother to the east.
To the east, my brother to the east, yeah.
To the east, my brother.
Sankofa is a word in the tree language of Ghana that translates as go back and get it. In an African-American and Afro-diasporic context, it represents the need to reflect on the past to build a successful future.
And we were looking for vibrations, feelings, and things that can't even be really understood on a music level, but you have to get scientific and look at things sonically to understand.
Interesting. Were you involved in that record by Hardcore at all? And that
yes,
Carson
take it
was?
From the top.
Take it from the top. Hardcore ain't done. Bass line and beat. Join it one. Style is correct. Harmony set check. Are we ready?
But did you produce that?
No, I didn't produce it, but I helped out a little bit, but I didn't produce it.
What was the relationship between that and X-Clan? Because you guys sort of came out the same year and
Hardcore?
Had some of the same people, yeah.
Well, actually, Hardcore are the ones that had the Black Watch movement. And they had red, black, and green and everything, and it just matched with what we were doing already. You know, being that Lumumba Carson is the son of Sonny Carson.
Lumumba Carson, a.k.a. Professor X, the overseer of X-Clan, is the son of civil rights activist Robert Sonny Carson. The elder Carson is best known for his 1972 autobiography, The Education of Sonny Carson, which was made into a film in 1974.
You know, we had the elders and the ancestors walking with us, advising us with a council of elders, so we were able to take the knowledge and information that we were getting from our parents and our elders and put it, translate it into hip-hop. You know, but Hardcore, they were a good group. But a guy named Chub Rock came out at the same time that Hardcore came out with the same beat.
Transforming, flowing, yo, go on. I'm not hot, but I'm hurting while I'm burning warm. I'm like a wizard.
Man, if you know anything, man, Chub Rock is a bad, bad man.
Yeah.
He's incredible. And his song had the same beat as our song, and his song was just flat out better.
Mm. And there was a lot that X-Clan talked about politically, and a lot of stuff that the Black Watch movement was involved in politically. And so many of those issues are still relevant today, and especially, you know, what's going on politically or coming back today. Some of the stuff that happened around the presidential inauguration, around the demonstrations around that, around arguments and discussions over punching Nazis that have popped up in the news over the past several days. You know, people are talking again about direct action, about property destruction, about the uses of violence in political movements. These were all debates that you were having in the 1980s and 1990s. What advice do you have for people, you know, especially young people kind of grappling with these same kind of debates right now in today's political climate?
Basically, what I would say to young people is don't wait for nobody to pass you a baton or a mantle. Don't look for a leader to follow. Be a leader. Be the change that you seek. And be a leader of yourself, your own body, your own mind, and your own community. Unify with people, but don't put all your faith in people and persons or personalities. Be the movement, be the ancestors, and be the person that you want the people that you look to as leaders. Be that yourself.
Interesting. And on your political, in your political life, what was the Black men's movement against crack?
The Black men's movement against crack was a bunch of brave brothers who would run up in crack spots, punch people in the face, take their money, tell them to get the hell out of our community. That was the Black men's movement against crack. Get the F off the corner. It's my hood. You will not do this around my women, my children, or my family.
Wow.
Period. And
when was this, more or less?
This was more or less in the 80s when the crack epidemic hit, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, when New York was New Crack City.
Right.
All Black men wasn't having it. In fact, in my community in Highbridge, Black people wouldn't even sell crack to each other. You know, they had to import people from the islands and people from third world countries into our communities to sell crack.
Okay. And, you know, there's one other thing about New York City and the political climate around New York City that is so important to X-Clan's story, you know, so important to that whole time. And that is the Yusef Hawkins situation.
And again in the streets of New York, I think of Yusef Hawkins and I see it still stalking. And when I think of areas like Benson Hearst, notice how I mention Hearst. We got to better this.
Yusef Hawkins was a 16-year-old Black kid who, on August 23rd, 1989, traveled to the predominantly Italian neighborhood of Bensonhurst with three friends to inquire about a used car. The four were attacked by a mob of between 10 and 30 white youths, at least seven of whom were wielding bats. One of the members of a mob had a handgun and shot and killed Hawkins. The incident increased racial tension in an already tense New York City. While the man who fired the shots, Joseph Fama, was convicted of second-degree murder, the other leader of the mob, Keith Mondello, was acquitted of murder and manslaughter charges, though he was convicted of several lesser charges. Mondello was released from Attica in 1998. Fama will be eligible for parole in 2022.
You know, people remember it, of course, but I think how it felt to be in the middle of that is a little bit lost to history. Can you give us an idea of what that situation was and what it was like for you as someone who was a Black nationalist and politically involved to be in New York City that was going on?
Unfortunately, you know, the Yusef Hawkins thing hit hard because of his age, because he was so young. But unfortunately, we've been so used to people so young or old, women, men, children, babies. This country never had respect for our lives. That's why we have to this day still stand up and say Black Lives Matter. And just hearing that hurts people who have been affected by white nationalism and by white supremacy. It hurts them to even hear us say Black Lives Matter.
Right.
But we don't say only Black Lives Matter.
But they hear that.
And we're not saying that all lives don't matter either. But what we're saying is that our lives in particular matter to us. And I like to add to it that if you're a racist or a pig kind of cop, whether or not my Black life matters to you is of no consequence. If your life matters to you, don't F with me.
You definitely showed that with the Day of Outrage.
Outrage! Blood to the concrete, tears to soil. And here's another word to make the other man foil. War. Raised on your planet to a cave boy oppressor. Hate one sends the aggressors.
The Day of Outrage was a demonstration in Brooklyn in late August 1989 to protest Hawkins' murder and other recent injustices against the black community. A crowd estimated by the New York Times to be about 7,500 took the Brooklyn Bridge and subsequently fought with police.
And that's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that all people have a God-given right to defend themselves when anybody oppresses them. All people have the right to stand up.
Yeah.
You know, the Jewish community is proud to stand up and say never again. But yet, I'm supposed to forgive and forget when others are championing never forget.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that ain't cool with me.
Yeah. What do you remember most about the Brooklyn Bridge Day of Outrage? What's something from that that
oh my God.
I mean, you've told kind of the general story a lot.
Down to the mortals and lead the wrath. Has to walk with trophies with the squealing of pigs. The niggas don't have permits and they've taken the bridge. What can you do?
What's a detail, a memory from that that you haven't shared so much?
That moment, that morning, X-Clan was filming its first video. It wasn't an X-Clan video, but it was a video that was being done by Afrika Bambaataa in the Bronx River called Nadi Oyama, Free South Africa, a song for Nelson Mandela.
A vainglorious way, vibes and colors. Free South Africa, free our mother.
Mandela, protected by the red, the black, and the green, with a K.
That also featured Master Rob and Diamond D and MC Light. Queen Latifah was in the video.
Mm-hmm.
It was banging, you know. So we were featured in the video. It was the first time X-Clan had ever participated in the video. And the march was going on at the same time. And so we're filming the video in the Bronx. And Sonny Carson's calling us on the phone like, yo, like, where y'all at? You know, the police done formed a line. And they getting ready to rush the people. Where are y'all? He was like, oh, we finishing up this video. Mm-hmm. He was like, man, if y'all don't get here right away, y'all gonna have problems. So we stole the van from the video company. And our getaway driver, who was also our road manager, we call him the Navigator.
Mm-hmm.
He got us from the South Bronx to the Manhattan foot of the Brooklyn Bridge in less than 15, 20 minutes. And the cops had it barricaded, but the march was at the other side of the bridge, at the Brooklyn side. So we abandoned the van at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, and we went running across the bridge. We broke through the police barricade. And, you know, we had just been filming a video, so we had the big red, black, and green flags. So nine of us come running across the Brooklyn Bridge from the Manhattan side with these big red, black, and green flags. And we're, like, up on the crosswalk. The people are down where the cars are.
Right.
So the people see us come running across the bridge with the flags, and the crowd goes crazy. And Amazing. We come down, and the people are on the front line. They had old people and children lock arms and arms, rocking back and forth, crying, singing, "We Shall Overcome." And we jumped down and took the front line and sent all the children, women, and the elders to the back of the line and turned that chant of FTP. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we started doing the black boot stomp because the police was, they do this thing before they charge you. They take the nightstick and they start banging on the shields.
Right.
Boom, 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 boom. Trying to intimidate you. So we start doing a black boot stomp. And you had a couple thousand cops, but we had like 40, 50,000 people. So that turned the trade. It turned the whole thing around that day. You could actually look up a Day of Outrage on the New York Times on the internet and you can hear the rest of the story.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have a song about it also.
Very famous song about it.
Yeah, exactly. So you have such an archive and a tiny fraction of it is in the book. Such an archive of hip-hop materials. I saw a video of it the other day, an exhibition of it in Pittsburgh where you had, you know, flyers and photographs and all this kind of stuff.
We're checking out the Paradise Collection. This is hip-hop history from the Paradise Collection. Yeah. Look at this. Oh, my God, the Fresh Festival. Look. Remember the Fresh Festival?
What made you want to start saving stuff?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, my big brother, Michael Green, he was a geek. Everybody else had Doug Big Brothers, and I had a geek big brother who's an artist. Well, he collected stamps and he collected coins. Ah, corny. I couldn't get into that. Then he started collecting comic books. Now he had my attention. But comic book collectors and comic book readers don't match. So me and my brother got in constant squabbles because I would take the books out of the plastic
and
read them.
Oh, and actually read them.
Yeah. And, you know, we having greasy potato chip fingerprints on books and stuff like that. So he banned me from reading his comic book. So I found another way to basically get with superheroes. And that was hip hop flyers. And you had Grandmaster Flash, Grand Wizard Theodore, you know, the L Brothers, you know, Cool Herc, the Mighty Zulu Nation. And you had, you know, this incredible Bronx Deco styles of these flyers and the amazing photography of Joe Gonzo.
Former,
you know,
friend of the show, Joe Gonzo. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
You know, Joe Gonzo. You know, come on now.
You can check out the man who took hip hop's baby pictures, Joe Gonzo, on episode 118 of The Cypher.
I was just blown away by the aesthetics of hip hop. And most of the guys on the flyers, I knew them. You know, they were like ghetto superstars. And I identified with them because they talked like me. They walked like me. They dressed like me. And at those times, the biggest star in our community was Michael Jackson. But you were not going to run into Michael Jackson walking down the block. That was totally inaccessible. It was like a dream for us. You know, we used to wear Thriller jackets and go to the clubs and wear the jeans with the penny loafer with the penny in it and everything. We loved Michael Jackson, but we couldn't be Michael Jackson, you know? So collecting hip hop memorabilia was a way for us to identify with the culture and the entertainment that we loved.
Wow. And you have an incredible collection now that, like I said, is sometimes in museums, parts of it and things
yes,
like that.
Yes. And the Paradise Collection is the foundation of the Universal Hip Hop Museum that we're building in the Bronx, you know, thanks to the hard work of my man Rocky Bucano, Curtis Blow, Sha Rock, Roxanne Shante, and Cutman LG, and Grand Wizard Theodore. I don't know if I mentioned Curtis Blow already, but, you know, just a great team of incredible hip hop pioneers, legends, new jacks, young people, and hip-hop intelligent people all around the world are coming together to build this incredible museum. And it's just amazing to be involved in it.
Yeah, and you have a location already about 30 blocks north of here?
Negative.
Okay.
We're looking at a couple of places, and a couple of things are looking really good, but we're starting with a virtual museum and an app. And that's what we're going to do. And as a matter of fact, we just came off a 5-city tour sponsored by Microsoft, going from L.A. to Detroit to Atlanta and back to Brooklyn yesterday to pick the brain of our hip-hop intelligence out there to come up with the best practices and what should and shouldn't be included in this museum that we're building.
Excellent. Well, we definitely want to hear more about that and all about the museum, but I wanted to wind down by asking about a part of your past that I haven't really heard people talk about, which is right around, you know, 1999 or so.
MP3.com.
You were at MP3.com right as, people may not remember this, right as the first dot-com boom was happening.
Yep.
You were right in the middle of that, a time that even our producer, Josh, was working in the dot-com boom. A lot of young people, you know, fresh out of college like he was. You were a little older. You were kind of in your mid-30s, I think, by that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what was the first dot-com era like for you?
It was amazing. Shout out to Michael Robertson and my boy Tyre Wilson, Dave Usakinen. You know, I've just met so many incredible people I moved, at that time I was living in Pittsburgh, and it's funny, a girl that I was crazy about was a musician, and she came to my house one day, and she saw my computer set up. She was like, oh, are you on the internet? I said, yeah. She said, oh, this guy put my music on the internet. I said, really? She said, yeah. I said, well, what website is it on? And she showed me mp3.com. At the exact time, I was working with like a lot of local artists in Pittsburgh, and I was looking to find a website to put the music on. And I was getting ready to go to a website where you had to pay $150 to upload your music to their site so you could have a spot that you could promote people to go online and hear your music. And then she shows me this mp3.com thing, and she says that, oh yeah, this white boy that produced our electronic song put us on here. I said, well, how much did it cost? She said it was free. I said, what? She said, it's free. So I went on the site, and sure enough, you could upload your music for free. So me, of course, I go directly to the hip hop section. The top 15 songs were 13-year-old white kids who could not rap A Christmas Present. It was the worst thing you ever heard in your life. But they know how to rock the internet.
Right.
So they're getting hundreds and thousands of plays, which is making them go to the top of the charts. So I was like, wait a minute here. So I started listening to every song and writing down the ones that I thought were good.
Back when you could listen to every hip hop song on the internet.
Yeah. No, well, I just went to mp3.com's charts.
Yeah.
And I went to each, you know, and I listened to hundreds of songs, and I found a bunch of stuff that was really good. And what I said was, well, if people don't know what to search for, they're going to click on anything. So the worst shit is going to go to the top if the people who make it know how to use the internet right and promote themselves. So I created a site called Yo MP3 Raps. And basically all I did was find hot hip hop songs on mp3.com and promote them and put them on my chart. And I learned that I can manipulate the chart at mp3.com. Whatever I started reviewing and pushing out to my people rose to the top of the charts.
Oh.
So I also found a whole lot of bootlegged songs that were misnamed. People putting it on their page saying it's theirs. And so I started making a note of those too. And they were just doing a whole lot of stupid stuff that was just totally unrelated to hip hop. And songs that weren't even rap songs were going up their charts because people were. So anyway, I started communicating with people at mp3.com like, yo, do y'all have anybody there that knows anything about hip hop or rap? And they said, no. And I said, well, y'all got so many problems y'all need help with. And They asked me for my resume, and it said, well, will you come out here and work for us? I was like, sure. So I wrote him back my resume, and the dude, he took 2 weeks to contact me, and he didn't call me back. I hit him back like, hey, what's up? He was like, is your resume real? I was like, yeah, it's real. It was like, well, it's kind of a, like really too good to be true. It's kind of like, really? Is this really true? Do you have references? I said, sure. Here's Russell Simmons' phone number. How's that?
Right.
You know,
right.
Here's Faith Newman, you know, the head of black music at Sony in Columbia. Try her. They were like, whoa, like you are connected. And they immediately, it was Friday, and a guy called me back. He was like, can you start Monday? I was like, dude, I live in Pittsburgh. You're in San Diego. He was like, so? They paid for everything. I moved out there, and I was working for one of the greatest dot-coms pre-IPO. And then we wound up creating the cloud technology and other technology like my.mp3.com, which they didn't understand. It's like we created what's going on now before it's time. And the record label sued us for $450 million and won.
We'll have links to information about this case, UMG Recordings, Inc., via mp3.com, Inc., in the show notes for this episode.
And all four labels settled with us. Universal would not settle with us. And they They won, and then they bought our company for another $250 million. And then they just sold off our technology and dissolved the company. And technology that we basically was the foundation of, that we basically pioneered, is MySpace, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all that, all of the variations of those things were created by us. And of course, iTunes. And because they sold off the technology without trying to understand it, they let the cat out the bag, and now they're getting their lunch ate anyway.
Wow.
So they might as well have settled with us.
And finally, I know you're heavily involved in the Universal Hip Hop Museum, and you have the book, No Half Steppin', An Oral and Pictorial History of New York City Club, the Latin Quarter, and the Birth of Hip Hop's Golden Era. What else is going on with Paradise Gray?
Oh, well, I have an organization in Pittsburgh called One Hood.
Mm-hmm.
That's a community-based organization that teaches young people how to use media literacy and social media to better their lives.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. This was fantastic. And I would love to have you back to, you know, talk about X-Clan and that whole aspect of your career and all the stuff that we didn't have time to touch on today. Thank you.
You know, there's a lot of chapters to this book.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paradise Gray.
My pleasure.
And normally that would be where the interview ended. But after we stepped away from the microphones, Josh and I got talking to Paradise. And of course, the recorders were still running. The conversation proved so fascinating that we had to bring you this extra segment. Once you hear it, you'll know why we couldn't leave this out.
And crazy enough, what's his name? B. Stinger, mm-hmm. who was molested by Bambada, was an intern at Strong City.
Right.
And that's what made me know that Bambada was lying. Because I just told you, I did the song Nadio Yama.
Mm-hmm.
We did the video. Guess what? We recorded it. Strong City Recording, Jazzy J Recording Studio.
Oh, and
where B. Stinger was the intern.
Mm-hmm.
I recorded your song at that studio, and he's the intern.
And now you're saying you don't know him.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I found a flyer with both of their names on it.
Right. And that was you that found that. Yeah.
It was me that found it.
I saw the flyer.
And it was me, the only hip-hop legend slash pioneer who stood up against Bambada immediately. Here's the thing, that the greatest lie ever told is that hip-hop is homophobic. That's the greatest lie ever told. If it was not for the gay community, hip-hop could not have done what it did in New York.
Because it was going to happen, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
The first articles written about hip-hop were written in the Village Voice. The first important articles.
Yeah.
You know, and the Village Voice and another newspaper from the Village.
Oh, the Village Eye or something, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then, if it wasn't for the CBGB, the Roxy, the Funhouse, Roseland, the Garage, the Palladium,
right.
Studio 54. Come on now. This was the gay community saying to us, when the black community said no.
Right. Yeah.
They said, we understand what it's like to be ostracized and pigeonholed.
Right.
And treated bad because of our culture. Come and party with us. And we partied with gay people every night. Because we were in gay clubs.
Sure.
But we didn't have to be involved. And this is the credit I give the gay community is that I was so young, I didn't even know what the hell gay was.
You probably weren't the only one, I'm sure.
You know what
and
I mean?
Not there was a
yeah, but
everybody
they
was
accepted our dancing.
Right.
And they supported us. And they opened their doors to us. And I respect that. And there was so many people involved in hip hop that were gay or bisexual or whatever that, you know, it's all a scam and bull crap.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I know for a fact what I saw when I was there.
Right. Yeah.
And nobody bothered me.
Sure. But
nobody bothered me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Come on.
Given the long-ago beef between X-Clan and Third Base, it might be surprising to some people that it was actually Third Base's Pete Nice who helped put this interview in motion. But old arguments aside, one thing Pete and Paradise have in common is a dedication to preserving the artifacts and the history of hip-hop culture. And Paradise is someone who has seen and taken part in far more than his share of history. From his early days with the great DJs, to his time at the LQ, to his work with X-Clan, to his current efforts with the Universal Hip Hop Museum, we could only begin to scratch the surface of Paradise's life and accomplishments in a single episode. Join us next week when we'll be talking to Faith Newman. Faith got her start working at Def Jam, back when you could count the number of employees on one hand. She moved to Columbia Records in the early 1990s, ended up signing Nas, and had an important role in the creation of perhaps hip-hop's single greatest album, Illmatic. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or use your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out another guest who knows how to put politics in his rap, Paris, on episode 136. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of February to get access to the March file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He think he wearing a chain, but he wearing my rent next month.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Harlem was on fire.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
We were stealing their music. You know, we're just a fad.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
And he was famous for doing the dance called the Snake Now.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Francisco Garcia.
We knocking out all bums. We knocking out all bums. Y'all ain't getting no money. All y'all getting is the crumbs.
And extra special thanks to Pete Nice for helping to make this interview happen.
Oh, yeah, this white boy that produced our electronic song put us on here.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
It's unavoidably New York.
Yeah.